support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, the number of people age 65 and older will nearly double by 2050, according to the Pew Research Center. Yet there aren't nearly enough geriatric medical specialists to tackle this aging population. We'll address key topics in healthy aging, such as choosing the right physician, avoiding loneliness, and navigating over medication. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. This Forum hour, we turn our attention to aging and what to do to avoid common mistakes as you or your loved ones age and how best to care for yourself or those you love and care about as the years take their toll. Joining us in studio, we want to welcome, first of all, Merdoud Ayoti. He is clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University Medical Center and co-author of a book called Paths to Healing Aging. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
Let me correct that. Past the healthy aging.
Right. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Good to also have Anna Chodos, who's here in studio. She's assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at University of California, San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much.
Glad to have you, and glad to have Karen Skultetty, who is vice president for health services with the Institute on Aging. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Glad to have you all, and let me begin, if I may, with you, Merdoud Ayoti, and let me begin by saying that I found your guidebook quite useful just in terms of telling us a lot of things that we know but maybe need to be reminded of, such as the importance of nutrition, the importance of physical exercise, and of keeping socially engaged, all of those kinds of things. But there's also something that maybe people aren't as mindful of, and that's what you call the drug cascade syndrome. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. People get prescribed a medication, they take the medication, it affects them with side effects, and they get on another drug, and then they get side effects with that, and it just cascades, like the
Correct.
Syndrome suggests. Ways to avoid this, because it really does have to be avoided.
Right. This is a great question. You know, this is a very common, actually, condition, and is more common, as you said, in elderly, because imagine if I give a medication to a young patient at the same time to the old patient, it's more likely that I misinterpret, actually, this side effect of medication in the old patient as a new medical condition. Like, for example, I give the medication that the side effect is a Parkinson-like symptoms. At the same time, young patient, I'm going to say, you know what, it's not likely the young person is going to have a Parkinson symptoms, and I will discontinue. But in an old patient, I say, well, it's Parkinson disease is very common in old people. That's why I'm going to actually give another medication, which is anti-Parkinson medication to cover this side effect. And this is an ongoing problem. Now, the problem is that what we are not looking that side effect of medications can happen in people even 4 months to 6 months after they start medication. A lot of us, we think maybe in the first 48 hours we're going to have a side effect, but it's actually is not true, especially for elderly people, because the metabolism is going to change, and that's why they have more prone to have a side effect during the time. The other problem is elderly people, they're taking multiple medication. And when we introduce a new medication, there is a chance that the new medication is start to have interact with other medication, and we're going to have a new side effect.
You can also be seeing a number of different doctors, which is part of the
problem.
This
is one of the problems. This is one of the most common problems, because the patients not get... And this is a tip of iceberg, Michael, because most of the patients, they even don't report to the doctors that they prescribe the medication, that they stop medication by themselves. They stop it. There's no any records in any medical record system. them, they go see another doctor. The next doctor, Dr. B, doesn't have information this patient already took this medication, and then prescribe another medication. And one of the reasons for drug cascade syndrome is a poor communication between the healthcare providers, because, for example, the patient's discharged from the hospital, and most of the things we do on a discharge summary, the primary care doctor or a specialist, they have no information about the medication. They put it on a hospital or nursing home, and when the patients come to them, they don't know about the previous medication they're taking. The other problem is a patient, because we have to train also the general public about that whenever they have any symptoms, it always could be adverse drug events, and it should be reported to the doctors that they're prescribing. Doctor shopping is the worst thing can happen in the drug cascade, because they go from Dr. A to Dr. B, a specialist. And then one of the things for a specialist, because a specialist is only take care of this yeast that they are trained, like heart doctor, heart, kidney.
They concentrate on the organ.
Exactly.
And the same thing, of course, with general practitioners, which we used to call them now,
primary.
Call them internists or primary care physicians.
Right.
It's also, I think, just a good idea to keep these medications separate, to keep lists of them, as you point out in your workbook, and that can be quite helpful. Or, you know, caring for aging parents, making sure that you get all these medications straight in terms of what's separate. The other thing I should mention here is that we did a program here in Forum a while back about UCSF, where Anna Chodos is professor of geriatrics, and it was all about how lack of communication causes so many serious medical errors. There's also something else I learned, and I want to ask you about this, Dr. Chodos, in Dr. Ayeti's book, and that is we don't have enough geriatric specialists, and there's a dearth of them, really, and this is going to be a problem as the tsunami of boomers get older. Terrible problem.
Yeah, this is a critical issue for us, and it's one that I think sometimes we aren't quite sure which direction to go in or how to really promote the profession in a way to really catch up. So maybe 300 new geriatric specialists from family medicine or internal medicine are trained, whereas we probably need something more like 2,000 a year to catch up. So I've seen one estimate that we need every geriatrician to behave as approximately 4 in the system to really cover the need that's out there.
We only got 8,000 in the United States.
Right. And we do actually know that we're not producing enough geriatricians to catch up with retirement rate among our colleagues. So including retirement rate and lack of sort of adequate training, we know that this is a critical issue and we're not going to have enough specialists. So another key approach that we see increasingly advocated for and which I would really agree for, needs to be emphasized, is training all of our colleagues across the board in every profession to be more competent in geriatric care. That includes primary care, psychiatric care particularly, but all specialists. So UCSF just started, as one small example, an orthopedic geriatric program.
Also, in Dr. Ayeti's book, he points out that a lot of people don't like to go into geriatrics, largely because payments come largely through MitoCare and through state insurance, and they have to go into nursing homes. I mean, all of these factors seem to thwart the idea of this as a specialty.
And a negative attitude toward aging in the public.
Yeah, which is, in fact, let's talk with you about this, Karen Scaltutti, because a lot of aging and helping aging has to do with attitude. Admittedly, people don't like to get old and see things falling apart and all the rest of that. And maybe we need a conversation, as I think you suggest, about some of the negative parts more than, oh, there's a 100-year-old who can run a marathon type of thing. But you do get into really the primary importance of attitude. Yeah?
Right. I mean, I think we need to make room for both, right? I think it's very important that we're talking about the ways that aging can be very positive, the wisdom that comes with aging, a lot of the tips that you have in your book about how people can really take control over their aging. But we also have to have room in the conversation for the fact that as people age, they may have a health event. In fact, it's likely they will have a health event somewhere along the way. It's likely that they may have a chronic disease diagnosis that they didn't expect. And can we make room in the conversation where we can both be very positive about aging and absolutely celebrate the 100-year-old marathon runner, but make room so that when people are struggling, we don't all just sort of turn away, which unfortunately tends to be what happens. And all three of us in geriatrics, we know that when we tell people what we do, one of the most common reactions I get is, oh, that must be very depressing.
Yeah, but they say that to oncologists too.
It's true. But I think people also see the hope in oncology sometimes and the things that it does. And the truth is there's a lot of hope in geriatrics as well. And it's not something that people talk about or make a lot of.
No, let's talk about that. What do you see as hopeful in geriatrics?
I think it's hopeful when...
What they're doing down at Google, trying to make us live forever? No.
I don't know if that part is hopeful. I think it's hopeful when we go from a period of... I mean, one of the things that really drew me to geriatrics was seeing people face a new diagnosis or a challenge or a stroke that they didn't expect, and that people actually rise to those challenges, that people are able to rally with the people around them and make connection and find new ways to interact with the world. And that's very hopeful. Or people who have limited or lost a lot of their social connections, when we're able to make a connection with those people, I mean, it is incredibly powerful how one connection can make a difference in someone's life. I find hope in that.
No, in fact, I'd like to talk some more about connections beyond. I mean, social networks don't help a great deal, as many people might think. We'll get into that. But the importance of making not only familial connections and keeping them preserved, but social connections and also spirituality. I've talked with Dean Ornish and others about that as a major factor. Let's get down to some basics, though, with you, Dr. Ayeti. There's a lot of unintentional weight loss. There's a lot of fatigue and feebleness that does come with age, decrease in physicality, and I don't want to emphasize the negative here, but it's a reality. Frailty and fatigue are realities. And yet you have the other thing, too, about people living a sedentary life and putting on a lot of weight and getting into excessive weight gain. So there has to be a balance physically, and the best medicine for that is what?
It's physical activity. Yeah. The one thing about the frailty, because first of all, no matter how healthy we live, when we actually reach around late 70s to 80, we actually lose 50% of our muscle mass. And this is part of the physiology of aging. Now, we can reverse that if we started earlier. The problem is that if we don't do it and we just wait and the frailty has become advanced, it's very, very hard to actually reverse the condition. Physical health definitely will help with overall stamina and also the alignments of for any person. The reality about the physical health, that a lot of people, they think that they do enough physical activity, and this is actually common in the public. There have been a group of colleagues, they did a study in 2004. They went to a lot of elderly people and asked, do you think that physical activity is beneficial for you? All of them, the answer actually, yes, it's very good. And they asked them, do you do enough physical activity? And I said, well, we do. When they continued the survey, they actually found that half of them, they actually don't have any leisure time to do activity. And half of them, they only have less than 1 hour to do physical activity a week. And that's not enough. We, in order to actually just reverse this condition, because the one thing we know as a people are experts in aging, the muscles are retrainable. We have, I call it 10 to 20 years of rejuvenation. It means if we start to doing it, there's a good chance that we actually can have a better physical health. And as also you mentioned about Dean Ornish and the study that Elizabeth Blackburn, the people of UCSF actually did this study, they actually showed that with physical activity and good lifestyle, we're even able to control our gene. It means our gene expression is going to be changed as well. It means a lot of good gene is going to be expressed. The bad gene is going to be downregulated.
Well, what kind of exercise? You need to sweat? You need to get your heart rate up?
That's a very good question. The basic exercise that we need is at least we need 150 minutes of aerobic exercise, which can be walking, just brisk walking, can be cycling, can be just swimming, for 150 minutes a week. And then beside of aerobic exercise, one of the most important part is strenuous exercise or resistance exercise. It means that they're starting to have, lifting weight. This is a great correlation now, and there's a good connection between a strenuous exercise and helpful with help with also cognition as well.
Again, lifting up weight helps muscle building too.
Not only muscles building, it also helps for the memory. We have a great evidence showing that people do a strenuous exercise. Actually, they do much better if they have mild cognitive insufficiency. 3 times a week, I call it for 20 minutes every time. Good. And then plus of that, balance training and also flexibility as well.
Well, when you mentioned not enough time for exercise with many people and the 20 minutes that you speak of, and Anna Chodas, let me go to you on this. There's also the problem, and Dr. Ayeti writes about this in his workbook as well, and the book, again, is called Paths to Healthy Aging. writes about the fact that, you know, when you go to a primary care physician, you can get all of about 20 minutes sometimes, and then things move very rapidly down that assembly line of medicine. It's a serious problem, especially if you want to make a connection with your doctor, if you want to have the kind of conversation that you need with the doctor. Again, it speaks to the need for more geriatricians and more time.
Absolutely. This, again, you get to another key issue that we deal with in primary care. And I should be clear, I do primary care, general primary care for adults and primary care for older adults and specialty geriatric care. So I think one thing we really emphasize is particularly for someone who has a lot going on, a lot of chronic medical or social issues going on, really trying to help them triage and helping to focus on sort of what's the thing most impacting their quality of life and their function that day. We also try to do as much as we can outside of the visit. So have other team members work with them to do the social history and social context, things that we could help them with in that regard, as well as other team members doing a medication review to help us with that. So you're always trying to find time extenders. But the bottom line is with particularly complicated older adults, we do need more time. And I think care models really are fortunately starting to move in that way somewhat.
Many of them want to age in place. I mean, this is also a big problem. I just went to a luncheon for San Francisco Village. I'll give them a plug here because this is what they work for. And I admire the work they do. But the sense of being able to stay in your own house can make an extraordinary difference.
Yeah, and that's the rationale behind in-home supportive services and Older Americans Act, which has some support for nutrition and preventive health and home care services. This is when you ask older adults what they want, which is what you should do, for many, it's to stay at home as long as possible and to be supported there. And I think that's, as a system, as a healthcare system and as a society, that is absolutely what we need to support.
I want to ask you one other question here, and that is because I know you work with a lot of underserved populations, especially Latino and Asian Americans in San Francisco, also African Americans, I presume. And the numbers are, again, pretty shocking in terms of the needs that that population is going to have.
You're absolutely right. And I think I'm not sure quite exactly what needs you're referring to, but I can say that among minority, racial and ethnic minority adults, there are higher rates of poverty. And so I think that is one key issue that constantly interferes with people's ability to be independent in the home, to get the transportation they need to doctors, to get the food they need. As one example, one of my patients, I couldn't help myself. She's an older African-American woman living alone. She has mobility impairment, uses a walker, but otherwise doing quite well for herself. Has some friends that stop by, but no routine support, no formal support like in-home supportive services. And she does her own shopping with a niece once a month. And I asked her how much she spent on food a month to get a sense of what she could afford. And she said, $90. That's her entire food budget for the month. And that is actually what SSI, for example, gives for food. So
you go to Whole Foods, that won't get you past maybe the first item there. Anna Chodos is assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at University of California, San Francisco. And Karen Scultetti is vice president for health services with the Institute on Aging. Let's talk about what we alluded to before with you, Karen, and that is how you build up better social contacts. And social engagement is so vital for those who are aging and really have older people find other older people. I mean, notwithstanding staying at home, actually going into the community in some sense or having the community come to you.
Yeah. We know that loneliness is one of the most powerful predictors of mortality in geriatrics. In fact, I heard a great quote that loneliness is as dangerous for you as smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. And we know that, you know, getting socially isolated is easy for people to do if they start to lose function or face chronic disease, have pain, not be able to get out of the home. And so the question becomes, you know, if you're able to get out into the community, where do you go to find like-minded people that share your interests, people that you actually connect and feel close to, or It is wonderful to get services in the home. The reimbursement models set up in our care system don't particularly support that right now. Hopefully that's something that will change over time. But, you know, Institute on Aging, we provide almost all of our services in people's homes because there are a lot of people isolated who not only do they not have social connection, they literally don't have any care because they can't get out of their home and there just aren't good options. So,
isn't there also data that shows that social engagement can not only help with depression, obviously, but also dementia?
Absolutely. So, you know, the idea that somehow these health conditions that people are facing is totally separate from how socially engaged they are or their mental health is just totally silly for us to even think that way, because the fact of the matter is those things are highly, highly connected. And what you're really looking for is one person who you can really trust. So the research says, you know, it's not the number of social connections you have, but do you have a true friend, a person you can tell anything to, a person you feel connected with? That actually ends up being one of the more powerful predictors of well-being, way more than if you have 400 friends on Facebook. Sorry for people who have that.
Okay. Let's talk about depression, though, with you, Dr. Ayeti. I want to get your take on this because you know, I remember when my father started aging, he was getting dangerous behind the wheel and couldn't drive. And then there are all these things to contend with. Think about people getting older and they lose their friends. Their family starts dying off. They outlive their family. Sexual dysfunction. I mean, we could just go through the whole range, a whole catalog. But to ward off depression, we're talking, of course, about exercise, about social engagement. But people can get into the thick of depression and not really know how to rise above it, especially when they're in this kind of elderly needing care stage. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? What do you suggest? I mean, just again, to other than the things that we're talking about, staying active and being socially engaged and so forth.
The reality is, first of all, depression is not common in elderly. I mean, this is the wrong thing to think that depression is actually more common.
I thought it was common, particularly in elderly women, isn't it?
It's in elderly women in comparison to men. But in when you compare the young people with old people, I mean, there's the rate of depression is not necessarily is actually higher in the old people. They actually, both of them, they can get depression, but the manifestation of depression is very different with the young people versus the old people. This is reality. There's a treatment of depression is the most challenging for all the physicians. I mean, if any physician has a choice between the patient that has a blood pressure and a depression, I will go to check the blood pressure. It's much better because the depression is continuing care. What does it mean that definitely we can get help from the medications, but the reality is medication is not the only thing for treatment of depression. This is a wrong thing. One of the wrong practice we do, especially as you mentioned very well about 20 minutes with Anna, only primary care visit. The worst thing can happen with depressed patient, go to the doctor's office in 15 minutes, prescribe antidepressant medication, ask them to, okay, just come and see me in 3 to 4 months. The saddest story is when you look at the treatment of depression, even with medication, most of the primary care doctors and either in any other doctors involved with actually treating depression, they even don't follow the protocols and guideline related to treatment of depression in elderly. We have a great guideline, 2006 Canadian guideline, 2001 U.S. actually experimented guideline, if they really follow, because this
is why we need more geriatricians. Yeah,
we need more expert that actually. This is one thing. This is because when we talk about elderly depression, we need somebody that is expert in geriatric, exactly know the guideline when we need to switch the medication, when we have a side effect, when is the time we need to change the treatment. Plus, you cannot treat depression without having psychologists on your side. This is absolutely wrong. I mean, I'm sure Karen's agree with me. It's a combination of medication plus psychologist. Then you can have a great and very interesting, Michael. If we have this both combination together, the rate of actually the cure and treatment is actually very high.
But a very important point to make, and thank you for making it. Well, we're talking about aging, and we're talking especially about avoiding common healthcare mistakes and how to enhance aging and how to deal with the kind of health problems that often both physically and mentally occur. We'd like to invite you to join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You can do that now by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement. Again, toll-free, you can join us at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or post questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate. We'd like to hear your thoughts. I'd like you to join the conversation with any questions or comments that you might have. Karen Scaldetti with us, Vice President for Health Services with the Institute on Aging. Anna Chodos, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at UCSF. And Meredith Ayeti, who is Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at Stanford and co-author of Path to Healthy Aging. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about what we talk about when we talk about aging, and the number of people age 65 and older will nearly double by the year 2050. That's according to the Pew Research Center. Yet there aren't nearly enough geriatric medical specialists to tackle this aging population, and we're discussing key topics in healthy aging, such as choosing the right physician, avoiding loneliness, and navigating over-medication, and you are welcome to join us. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or you can email your thoughts or questions to us at our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's an online comment from Gene who says, can you discuss vitamins? I had been taking them for a long time and spending tons of money on them. And Chodos, you have some strong feelings here, especially not only about vitamins, but maybe vitamin supplements you can share?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. And I think there's a lot of, obviously, allure to vitamin supplements. I would say more often than not, I've seen it do harm to the wallet than I've seen it do benefit to health. And so I would just caution, particularly most patients that I see that bring in supplements are often on many. They are not innocuous entirely, although I know there was a study that showed that many of them mostly contain dust as well. But some of them do have active agents. They interact with each other. They interact with prescription medications. And they're expensive. And they tell you to take two or three times a day. So I would caution that at least if you're taking them, to bring them with you as if they're a medication and to talk to your physician about it. The other thing I often caution patients about, and I routinely ask, is any over-the-counter medications. So things that are entirely innocuous or safe or great when you're younger can have adverse effects when you're older. So particularly sleep agents. Benadryl, which is perfect for babies, helps them go to sleep, and for allergies can cause confusion and urinary retention and all sorts of things nobody wants. And even things like routine pain relievers, particularly non-steroidals like ibuprofen or naproxen, things like that can cause kidney injury and bleeding. So I'm very cautious, tell people to be very cautious with those, much more so than things like Tylenol.
And Karen Scaltetti, here's a question that you should knock out of the park. How many problems in old age could be avoided by developing a healthier lifestyle earlier in one's life?
A lot of them. Most, yeah, right. The idea that we should wait for some age and then start working on some of the health recommendations or physical activity or start building, you know, real social networks with real people we can talk to, that we should wait till later in our life to do that, probably not the best plan. We're all aging, and we need to proactively be thinking about where we're going to go when things are going well, and also making sure we got a good network for when we hit those challenges.
And we're going to hit some more of your calls. Let me go to Steve as our first caller up. Steve, hi.
Good morning. I'm calling from Fremont, and my question regarding anxiety and fear in terms of aging. My mother is 103 years old, up until November, had lived on her own, independently, doing her own cooking, and I believe a neighbor told her that she had fallen a few times in the house, and the neighbor told her she really needs to have care, because otherwise if she breaks her hip, it's going to be a game changer. So my mother, every person who fell, basically she felt like it was happening to herself. She became more and more careful, even though she was walking without a walker before that, started using a walker, and wound up getting an aide, and now has 24/7 care, is afraid to be left alone, is not doing any cooking, hasn't gone to synagogue, which she used to do twice a week. And so I try to encourage her when I go there to visit. I'm on the West Coast. She's on the East Coast. I get her out of the house, even though it's a battle to finally do that. But how do you deal with it? The doctor doesn't want to prescribe anything for anxiety because she's on medications. My mother is not the type to be open to counseling or therapy. How can I try to get past this fear or get her to, you know, realize how the fear is negatively impacting her condition.
All right, short of medication for anxiety, Steve, really your question is what can be done for her and to diminish that anxiety or get it under control. Some wisdom from
Sure. I mean, what you're talking about, Steve, is a common experience. Actually, there's some good research that shows that people who develop a fear of falling actually become more likely to fall than people who don't develop that fear, exactly for the reasons that you're talking about, the cautiousness, the lack of physically engaging themselves. So I don't know if it makes you feel better or worse just to know that you're not alone, that this is an anxiety that develops for a lot of people who end up having falls in their home. I think, you know, probably the reason, and my medical colleagues in the room can speak to this, probably the reason they're not wanting to prescribe medications is that the anxiety medications that are out there can be very dangerous for older adults, especially for older adults who might fall and can really add to that cascading drug syndrome that we talked about earlier. You know, one of the programs we have at the Institute on Aging is a program called the Friendship Line, and it's a line where people can both call in when they're feeling lonely or depressed, and it's also a line where we call out to people. And part of the reason we called it the Friendship Line is because a lot of older adults, like your mom, very resistant to the idea of having psychotherapy because of the stigma, especially for her cohort with mental health. So figuring out something that could offer engagement with another person, even if it's not called therapy, can actually be a good treatment for anxiety. And depending on where your mom lives, you know, you could go through case management or other aging organizations there to see what's available. But, you know, you have to start slow with anxiety. And thinking about, you know, simple social engagement is really important. Her caregiver who's going into the home, if that's not someone who she actually feels very connected with, that's only going to add to the anxiety that she's experiencing. If that starts to be someone she can trust and talk to, that person actually can end up playing a pretty key role in the anxiety. So,
Steve, good luck to you, and thank you for your
good
call.
Luck.
Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Kevin. Kevin, join us.
Thank you very much, everybody, for being on the front lines and dealing with what is going to be an increasingly problematic systemic issue and being unable to look after the number of aging we have. It was in the hospital experience of cancer, an age-related disease, that I became acquainted with the other elderly. Well, I'm not elderly. I'm a 53-year-old man. Caused me to change my entire life around to study the biological mechanisms of aging, and I'm finishing a PhD studying cellular senescence right now. But I've come to the realization in the field that I'm in that there are ways of currently optimizing the aging process through, say, potentially pharmaceutical means, and increasingly we're understanding that there may be drugs that can help slow the aging process and thus avert or at least delay an awful lot of the age-related types of problems that you guys are encountering. And I'm wondering, what is the responsibility of geriatricians and other people who deal with the, you know, the fallout of the cellular damage that gives rise to age-related diseases? What's the responsibility of geriatricians to interface with those low-level types of technologies to start sort of bringing that out into the public so that we can do something about this disease in a timely manner and take advantage of these new technologies?
All right. It's a pertinent and salient question. Meredith, IIT?
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, one of the things that I believe this is the problem, which is ongoing problem. As you said, in 2050, the number of the actually elderly will be double. And for the first time in history, the number of elderly will exceed young people. We will face a lot of challenges because as the last call actually we had, the one of the other problems we haven't addressed that a lot of these children in the future, when they have to take care of us, means my son is 2 years old when I'm going to be geriatric, I'm just feeling so bad for him because, if you think about it, that he has to raise his own family and also the same time taking care of me as well. But what happened is our healthcare system is actually going in the wrong way with the highest speed. Now, the problem is in the next 15 years from today that you and I, we are all talking about here, when this number is going to be double, we haven't had any plan to first teaching the people that what they are facing when they're aging, even for the last call that was if we have, we noticed that if we have preparation for people years before, they can actually adapt themselves. Even for example, if they're going to have a fall and frailty, they're able to actually adjust them even when we have a conversation to move to assisted living facility. It doesn't bring a lot of anxiety for them. Now, as far as the high tech, it comes to helping with the aging. If this system is ongoing, which is still the heart of Medicare, is the fee-for-service, which now we know the last couple of weeks the Senate is starting to change the conversation, but because I believe as a geriatrician that Medicare needs a heart transplant, something new. We have to really learn from other countries like Great Britain and then other countries that what is the best system for our elderly people as far as healthcare, instead of spending money to, for example, putting pacemaker in somebody of 95 and is actually going to die in 2 months, which I had this patient with the advanced dementia, is spending money for a lot of other resources, like, for example, psychologists, expanding the technology in the healthcare system, increase education for other specialties with all this 8,000 geriatrician that we have, increase education for also nurses, social workers, pharmacists, and a lot of other disciplines in geriatric. This is the way we need to go. Otherwise, the future will be the bad tragedy and a disaster.
I have to go towards socialized medicine, single payer, that kind of
thing. But at least we can learn from our colleague at the UK. I mean, we had Dr. Elder as the chief of geriatric, came to Stanford a year ago, and he was sabbatical. And we're just comparing the system together. I mean, even for education that Anna was saying, in United Kingdom, for every single medical school, they have one separate geriatric department. In United States, for 145 medical schools, we only have 11 medical schools that they have geriatric department. This is sad. It's only 11%. And none of our medical students in the 3 years, they actually have any mandatory training in geriatric. Less than 1% of our nurses, they are trained in geriatric. Less than 3% of our advanced practice registered nurse with nurse practitioner in geriatric.
Well, that's why things are going more toward nurses and toward just regular physicians. Family physicians or internists. Anna, you want to add something here? Anna Dutta?
Yeah, I think what the caller was getting at, and I really apologize for forgetting your name, is that, we have a disease-oriented system, not a wellness-oriented system. And I think one that would be truly comprehensive would also acknowledge the key value of social services to health and in preventing a lot of decline in older adults. And so one thing the UK does very well and peer nations do very well is they invest in social services. So the ratio of investment in social services to health services is about 2 to 1, whereas here it's 0.9, 0.8. So I think that speaks volumes about how we feel our investments, how our philosophy drives our investments in health. And in terms of some of those treatments, I think a lot of those are somewhat experimental and sort of not in the mainstream in terms of medications to reverse aging or caloric restriction diets to help reverse aging. But we do know that, good health in middle age leads to more likely good health in older age. So continuing the recommendations that we've all been saying about social engagement and physical activity, for sure.
Anna Chodos is assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at UCSF. Here's a tweet from a listener named Jeffrey who would like to respond to this. What's the impact of financial insecurity on senior health? Anna, you're nodding your head. It's considerable.
It's considerable. I think we know that financial insecurity, poverty, really leads to social insecurities, food insecurity, housing insecurity. So at least a third of adults will say that after they've paid all their bills or essential bills for a month, they have nothing left over. So if we consider that most older adults also are more likely to have a health crisis or a social crisis, a spouse getting ill, some other need, we can consider that those folks are very economically insecure. And we do know that supporting food programs and better nutrition in older adults supports wellness in older adults, keeps them out of nursing homes, keeps them independent at home. So I think for our money, social dollars are a very wise investment. And that includes supporting things like Social Security, which keeps many older adults out of poverty, and social programs.
Karen Scaltetti, some questions about exercise and sleep, and obviously they play a central role, both of them, in terms of mental health and longevity. But here's Daryl, who writes, at 77, I joined a gym and promptly hurt my back, which led to a groin pull. I was not overdoing anything. How do you balance workouts with risk of injuries? And Roxana says, I exercise 10 to 12 hours a week, biking, swimming, some weights, walking, and yet it often takes me 2 to 3 hours to fall asleep. I use some over-the-counter sleep aids, have not gone to prescription sleep aids yet. So we've got we've got exercise and sleep there. I mean, and actually we've done programs with the Stanford Sleep Center, and they talk about how there really is a connection between exercise and sleep and getting a good sleep based on how much exercise you do, but overdoing exercise and affecting your sleep. And now there are a lot of recommendations now about naps and sleeping not too much but not too little. I mean, they're, like with exercise, there has to be a balance.
Right. It gets complicated. I mean, all things in moderation, I suppose. You know, we have to be able to ask other people for help sometimes in figuring out how to address these things. You know, and I just want to add that the systemic issues that both of my colleagues here are talking about in the healthcare system and in financially how we're setting things up, I mean, a lot of that is reflective of our attitudes about aging in this country. We're not proactive. We wait till the moment of crisis to talk about the difficult things. We don't put resources into social care, and we don't put funding into aging as well. You know, less than Institute on Aging is a nonprofit, so we know this well, and we provide mostly social services, you know, less than 2% of foundational funding goes to aging. So what does that say about what our society is valuing in older people, what they're seeing in older people? We've got to change the conversation to really see that hope that I talked about earlier, but also really allow for people to say, if we aren't proactive about this, we are going to find ourselves in a wide crisis, but we're also going to find many of us in individual crisis, and I think proactively we could be preventing that. So all things in moderation with both exercise and sleep, and let's change the conversation so that we can talk to other people about what we need to age well.
And let's bring on more of our callers. George joins us next. George, you're on.
Good morning. Congress recently passed a Medicare bill just a couple weeks ago with cuts to elderly benefits, increases in fees and deductibles. The stated objective of the bill was to encourage seniors to use their doctors less often. So my question for your guests, are there any concerns in the physician community that this change to Medicare will have an adverse effect on the elderly patients?
Well, who would like to take that? I think we're going to defer to you, Dr. Yadi.
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, this is one of the things, because Medicare has actually noticed, especially with the latest Congressional Budget Office report, showing that even with a slowdown on the Medicare spending, it's still the long-term actually trajectory is very unsustainable. Just in 2014, Medicare spent more than $600 billion for just Medicare. And now think about it, baby boomer generation that we're talking about, it, Medicare spending will increase, because one of the other problem is technology-driven healthcare system. We are encouraging all the hospital to become more electronic, and this is all costs a lot. Plus, the other problem is actually a lot of people actually, numbers of the workers per Medicare beneficiary actually will drop. And that definitely contribute to financial crisis and challenge for the Medicare. Medicare is starting to have some program like Medicare Advantage. Even the past, basically the bills and discussion in the last 2 to 3 weeks about a Medicare, because if we go to the Medicare Advantage plan, at least there is a good things about it that, I mean, out of pocket of the patient may be sometime higher, but the good things about it that at least they can pay for more performance, like this is a continuity of Affordable Care Act, that at least we are not going to penalize the doctors or even the healthcare system for spending time with the patient, because currently if the doctor is spending time with the patient, they actually get penalized.
And let me thank the caller, and go to an online comment here, which I think can be useful, from Daniela, and I thank her for it. She says, to combat the elderly depression associated with loneliness, it always helps to include and give people the sense of being needed. In France, there is a project in which the elderly are recruited to be part of the daycare of preschool children. This has proved positive for both the children and the elderly. They have the same sense of time, and traditionally, this was the way large families function. It also supports two of the groups in our society that do not have deep-pocketed lobbies.
Right.
Really good advice. And by the way, animals can be great, too, when you're lonely and aging. You know, they used to say, if you don't have a friend in Washington, get a dog. here's Jay, who writes online, my experience has been that most doctors dismiss the idea that any symptoms are the result of side effects from drugs and just add more drugs on to combat the side effects, the drug cascade that you spoke of earlier. In addition, they rarely consider guidelines and diagnostic algorithms, even when asked directly about them. How do you find a doctor who is willing to practice thoughtful medicine? It's a tough question for us, but let's get some wisdom from any of you want to come forth here. Anna Chodos?
Well, I wish I could say there was a, you know, just go to your local geriatrician. It can be hard to find one.
Yelp, yeah.
Yeah. There is a website, healthandaging.org, that does, if you put in your zip code, does indicate what geriatricians are in your area. And being the Bay Area, good places to look are UCSF. We have several programs, Stanford.
But social media do evaluate doctors. I mean, you don't always necessarily get a fair assessment, but, you know, you do get assessments.
I think a key lesson, and this is unfortunately a huge challenge that we have, which is the competency of most physicians is not where we'd love it to be when it comes to geriatric conditions. I've never met a physician that was not well-meaning. But the truth is, in undergraduate medical education, so medical school and in residency, we do not get exposed to enough geriatrics or have formal curriculum in geriatrics like we should. So I encourage you to internet search on medical school curriculums and see how many have geriatrics that pop up. It is relatively few, as Mayor Dodd was saying earlier. But
would you like to meet a non-well-meaning physician?
I do not want to meet one. I
be arranged.
But I think it's true. We do put a lot of work in the lap of our patients. They need to be their own advocates. Our caregivers need to be advocates. And the truth is, if you're not finding a physician that works for you, you do need to, as I know we said not to earlier, but doctor shop a little bit and talk to them about what's important to you. Yeah. Being clear about your own values and your own goals is another key feature of aging well. And that's a hard thing to do, but it is something that more and more tools are coming out for people to be able to learn how to talk about their goals in the context of healthcare and make that known to their physicians. Some resources, just, you know, Atul Gawande has put out a lot of stuff recently about how to do that, how to talk to your physicians about goals. And the Conversation Project has some good materials. And just overall, there are a lot of good materials out there if you do internet search.
Tal Gawande's not at Stanford. Is he at Stanford?
No, he's at Boston Harvard.
Yeah. But you should apply the same kind of wisdom we're hearing from Anna Chodos, Karen Scaltetti, to finding a good psychiatrist or psychologist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is another area, mental health providers, social workers, it's another area where unfortunately, and psychiatrists, we're unfortunately quite short in the number of people who are specializing in geriatrics there as well. But I think any provider that you're working with, if you feel like you can't have conversations with them, you've got to advocate to make space for those conversations. Unfortunately, the system is working against you to have those. So you've got to advocate for time and space. And, you know, earlier when the caller asked about, you know, this idea that people would overutilize seeing their primary care physician, you know, from a financial perspective, I would sure rather have them overutilizing their primary care physician and not be overutilizing emergency rooms and hospitals, which is costing us a lot more money. And if we made some time and room for those conversations, we would actually be saving ourselves a lot of money. So it's unfortunate that we're not making more time for that. I'll take some overutilization there as opposed to in the hospital.
And again, Karen Scaltetti is Vice President for Health Services with the Institute on Aging. And here's Barbara from El Granita. Barbara, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm quite concerned about my parents.
She's concerned about her parents.
She wanted to ask about her father refusing care, I believe, which, of course,
she can tweet at us later.
Yeah. You can tweet us, by the way, maybe if you don't have a touchtone phone or if you have a touchtone phone, excuse me. But she wanted to know about, and this is, I think, probably not an uncommon problem. Her father happened to be a physician and he didn't want care. And a lot of older people don't want care. They don't want care because of the expenses, but they also don't want care because they're sometimes obstinate and they don't want to admit or they're in denial. Yeah.
That's true. But one thing is, again, last night somebody asked me about, there was a lecture in the public library, and asked me that the good things that in modern society we have more access to the doctors means this actually help us with successful aging. I'm kind of like against that. The reason is because when you compare traditional society versus modern society, you see the people in the traditional, I'm coming from traditional society, an aging population, even they don't have access to the doctors, they have actually very enriched life. I mean, they're socially, they're very enriched, they're very healthy, they're actually doing great. I mean, this is exactly the point that we were talking about. Attitude toward the aging is very different between traditional society and modern society. We need to change this negative attitude. Aging was a sign of honor in our history, now becomes a sign of shame and fear. That's why a lot of elderly people, they don't ask for help. Because they just fear. They just wanted to, because they see society will label them with the old person. Even they don't like to walk with a walker or cane, or even they don't go and get a hearing aid because they don't like in the meetings everybody says these are the old people.
There's also a problem with people getting older that they become invisible.
Correct.
I mean, you can call it ageism or whatever you like, but people just don't even notice them or take cognition of them. And here's Scott who writes, please ask how learning new tasks can help our cognition. I suppose that goes without saying.
Absolutely. Very, very. And I refer everyone to look at the taxi driver study in London, actually showing the people are versus bus driver in London. They have a larger hippocampal area, which is a center for brain for memory. And it's amazing because it's very challenged to drive in the streets of London. And that's good.
I'll add one thing, which is adequate hearing and vision is actually really important. If you just think about your brain needs those inputs to maintain function, that's the same reason physical activity helps the brain is just simply.
Yeah, but you brought up an important point there that I noticed when my parents started losing their hearing, they became a lot less aware of what was going on. They kind of tuned out because they couldn't hear. And as a result, they would fall more into kind of a dementia.
Right.
And it's why hearing is so crucial. I mean, so is vision, obviously, all of our senses. But I think people who can't hear do tend to turn to simply tune out. And as a result, you have consequences. Here's May who writes, can you address the issue of how to get proper dental care as we age? My father, who fortunately lived to 95, spent over $15,000 on dental care in the last 2 years of his life, big chunk of his savings at that point, because he didn't have proper dental insurance to help pay expenses to maintain proper dental care. And since we know that dental health is essential to overall health, how can we come up with a better way for aging persons to maintain good dental health without spending all their savings on it?
That's exactly the point that we talk about. Our healthcare, Medicare system should, I mean, have to change the direction from fee-for-service for paying for a lot of procedures that is unnecessary for people to really the procedure that are actually essential. I mean, if you guys are agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, because people are losing their, I mean, especially when they need constant care and you know, they're debilitated to a degree, they're losing their whole life savings.
Yeah. Correct.
I mean, it's, dare I use the word, criminal.
Yeah.
On that note, I want to thank all of you for a most illuminating hour and one that I hope will be useful to our listeners and in fact suspect that it will be very useful. So thank you for the public service of being with us. And Dr. Meredith Ayeti, again, is clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford Medical Center and co-author of Paths to Healthy Aging. Anna Chodos is assistant professor of medicine with the Division of Geriatrics at University of California, San Francisco. And Karen Scultetti is vice president for health services with the Institute on Aging. Thank you, one and all.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online at kqed.org/forum. We will be back with you on the morrow if all goes according to plan. We're going to talk about new studies in ecstasy tomorrow. New studies that the FDA is allowing. Can they be used for psychotherapy? Yes, apparently they can, and we'll find out more about that on the morrow. We'll also have a leading local fiction writer with us tomorrow as well. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, simply email us, forum@kqed.org. Forum's producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.